It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. I'm actually Jason Chaffetz, filling in for Brian. Say, take a little R&R, a little rest and relaxation, which is so unusual for Brian Kilmeade. He's like the hardest working guy out there. He's always, you know, between doing Fox and Friends and the radio show and everything else he does and writing the books. But I'm honored to fill in for him. I'm a Fox News contributor, former member of Congress. And I actually have one of my former colleagues who's going to join us on the line now. Sean Duffy, the former congressman from Wisconsin. He's working with Fox Business now. He's the co-host of The Bottom Line on Fox Business. Sean Duffy. Sorry to wake you up so early, but thanks for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, Jason Chaffetz. Good to be with you as well. You need to just kind of take over the studio. Brian's out and Jason's in. I love it. And again, we get to work together at Fox. We were together in Congress, and we can't get away from each other. We just keep working together, and I love it.
Well, that, you know, there's a lot of downside to being in Congress. It's a tremendous honor to serve, but you do get to meet some people along the way that you really enjoy and that you'll be friends with the rest of your lives, and you're one of those guys that's just perpetually happy and positive, and really enjoyed hanging out with you and you know, obviously your wife Rachel as well.
Jason, I was always a dour, sad human being until I met you in Congress, and I'm like, that is the way a man should live his life, just be happy with a sunny disposition like Jason Chaffetz. But you mentioned Congress right now, and I think it's fascinating. I've had a chance recently to talk to some of our former colleagues, and you know, there was a lot of conversation about all these old members in Congress and how we need to you know, get new blood in there. Well, it's a lot of people have retired over the course of the last 10 years, and almost half the conference has been there less than 5 years. They're all really new,
yeah.
But they have no institutional knowledge of how it's supposed to work and how you get things done. Then with this slim majority, you see they're having real problems. They give campaign speeches at home, then they go to Washington, and because they can't figure out how to work together as a party, you know, our budget for the most part is what Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, and Mitch McConnell put together right before Kevin McCarthy became the speaker, a little over a year ago. And that's, we're still funding the government at those levels. And they ran on trying to fix the budget and the spending, and they can't even get that done. And I think it's going to be really frustrating for a lot of members who want to make a difference in the country but don't seem to be able to. Because,
well, to have a majority of just what, you know, to only be able to lose 2 votes along the way is, I mean... It's just so untenable in order to get from here to there. But, you know, I want to talk a little bit about 2024. I mean, obviously, we're right in the thick of it. They got primaries. We had this primary coming up, a really important one here on Saturday in South Carolina. Now, I don't know where you are on this, but I truly believe that this is Nikki Haley's, the ambassador, the former governor of the state of South Carolina. If she doesn't win here, I, what's the justification for continuing on? I want to play this little clip from a former colleague of ours, somebody who served in the House, who's now the senator from South Carolina. He was on Hannity last night. Go to Cut 11, and Sean, I want you to react out of this.
Well, I hope that she's dropping out the race, to be honest with you. Here's what we know. She can't win her own home state. There's no other state in the nation. If you can't win your home state, there's no other place to win. She's down by at least 25 to 30 points here in South Carolina. The best thing she can do for the nation is to drop out the race, endorse Donald Trump, and let us start focusing on Joe Biden.
Your thoughts, Sean?
Well, so that's powerful. And just to give a little background, it was Nikki Haley when she was the governor of South Carolina. And Tim Scott was in the House with us as a U.S. congressman. Their senator left from South Carolina, and it was Nikki Haley who actually elevated Tim Scott to be a senator from South Carolina. They have a long relationship, and Tim Scott owes a lot to her. And when he says, listen, it's time for Nikki Haley to get out, she can't win, I don't think that comes lightly. That has to come from a lot of reflection when you want to say those words, especially on Hannity. So I don't know what she's doing, Jason. At some point, you do have a little bit of honor, hopefully, left. You don't want to be embarrassed. But she keeps going on. Again, she's the most recent polling I've seen, and she's down by 30 points. So is she staying in because she thinks that the Republican Party is going to miraculously change its base and move towards a more neocon George Bush candidate like her? Is she thinks she's going to win those voters back by staying in against Trump when she runs in 2028? Is she trying to get corporate boards? I don't know what the strategy is here. She has the money to stay in the race. But the long-term play politically doesn't make sense unless there's an afterlife that she's looking at, you know, in business or in corporate America. And again, I can't figure it out because usually you look at the numbers and you're like, listen, it's hard. It's tough for me. I've run hard. I don't like Donald. She would say, I don't like Donald Trump and where he wants to take the country. But I have to recognize the voters are expressing their will and it's not for me. Get out. So I what do you think? I mean, does she, I think she's going to stay in after she's going to get crushed in her home state of South Carolina. And I think she's going to stay in. I mean, what do you think?
I think she should have gotten out before. I think when Donald Trump took 98 out of 99 counties in Iowa, that was pretty devastating. And the one county he lost by literally one vote to Nikki Haley in one county. I think she should have dropped out then. It depends what your long-term game is. I think she's taken so much money from so many people who are saying, no, we want an anti-Trump candidate. That's you. That's why we gave you all this money. You got to stay in and keep making his life difficult. I don't think life is difficult for Donald Trump with Nikki Haley in the race. It's not having much of an effect, if any. But again, like I look at Ron DeSantis, and, you know, he had all the promise in the world. He was doing exceptionally well. But I thought the way he exited the stage was pitch perfect in terms of where he's trying to go. Because in the best case scenario, if Donald Trump does win another term, he's only there for 4 years. And so the moment he gets sworn in, all the talk will be about the election in 28. And Ron DeSantis is probably as positioned as well as anybody, having gone, you know, exited the stage gracefully and made a good pitch. You basically said, look, hey, I am the Donald Trump candidate in terms of policies, but I don't come with all the baggage and all the drama. And so, you know, what's Nikki Haley going to do? I think the longer she stays in, the more she harms herself if she wanted to run again.
I think that's really good. I think that Ron DeSantis is the front runner no matter what in 2028 because of how he's been a governor in Florida.
Yeah.
How the country has looked at how he's governed in Florida and how he exited the race. Yeah, he was tough on Trump. But listen, if you're going to run in a primary against Donald Trump, you're going to have to be tough on him. And Ron DeSantis was, but he did exit gracefully. He hasn't been on the campaign with Donald Trump, but he did endorse Donald Trump. But you know, Nikki Haley, it's almost a Liz Cheney strategy, right? It's like I'm going scorched earth against Donald Trump. It has almost become personal, where she's trying to flamethrow him with the same talking points that the Democrats use, which has created a unique situation. Nikki Haley is the most popular Democrat in the race in South Carolina. They love her.
Yeah,
that's
the problem. That's the problem. All right, real quickly, I want to get your thoughts on the new shoe line from Donald Trump, but let's listen to him talking about it's Sneaker Con in Pennsylvania, Cut 15.
I just want to tell you, you know, I've wanted to do this for a long time. I have some incredible people that work with me on things, and they came up with this, and this is something I've been talking about for 12 years, 13 years, and I think it's going to be a big success. Your influencers have been very positive. They've been real influencers, and they love it, and they love what we've done. That's the real deal. And we're going to remember the young people, and we're going to remember Sneaker Con. You know that. We're going to remember the young people especially that wear sneakers, right?
I mean, from out of nowhere, all of a sudden, the president is pitching sneakers and they sell out in a moment's notice. I mean, what are your thoughts?
This is the trouble with radio. I would love if we were on a Zoom or a podcast or a TV where I could actually see your gold sneakers, your Trump sneakers that you're wearing.
I couldn't get any. I would have gotten them, but I couldn't. I'd take out a loan to go get them, but, you know, they're kind of pricey, but.
I think they're $1,000 a pair or something. But you know what? This is what's so unique about Donald Trump. I mean, he's going to the UFC fights, but he's going to Sneaker Con, and he's touching people. I mean, I didn't know there was such thing as a Sneaker Con. I don't know if you knew that.
No.
But all these people go and they love their Sneaker Con, and lo and behold, Donald Trump shows up, and. People who may not have had a preconceived notion of Donald Trump before SneakerCon that went there, they're like, I actually like this guy, and he likes sneakers too. I'm going to give him a look, and I might actually go vote in November of this year. Really smart politics, touching people where they sit.
You know, this is the magic of Donald Trump, right? He's this billionaire, highly successful New Yorker, grew up in New York. But he's able to touch and connect with the blue-collar people, voters, low-propensity voters probably. I'm just guessing who shows up at SneakerCon. But, you know, if you're at SneakerCon, you probably also have a little bit of money because, you know, these sneakers aren't cheap. And he's just touching a demographic that Joe Biden – I mean, I just always put it in the filter of, could Joe Biden pull this off? I mean, what would happen if he showed up?
I don't think anyone would come to the event. No one wants to buy it. A Joe Biden sneaker or a Joe Biden policy. They actually don't want to buy a Joe Biden presidency right now. But, you know, Donald Trump has the pulse on America. For some reason, again, it's a really good point. He's a billionaire from New York, has not lived a life like any of us, right? He's lived in a different world, but understands where the average men and women are, which has been the key to his success. You probably saw this in Utah. I would go to in 16, I was still in Congress, and I would go to these rallies that because Trump, Wisconsin was a swing state. I go to these rallies, and I'm like, I have never seen any of these people anywhere in Republican politics in our state. They came out of the woodwork to come out, and they weren't Republicans. They were Donald Trump supporters, and they loved him, and which was the magic of this, you know, this movement that he's built across the country. Of telling people and actually doing it when he was president, I'm saying, I'm going to fight for you. I'm going to be your president. Yes, fantastic. And now he's at SneakerCon. You can't write this. You can't write this in a book.
Sean Duffy, he's the host of The Bottom Line. This is on at 6 p.m. Eastern on Fox Business with Dagan McDowell. It is a great program. If you get a chance, check it out. And Sean Duffy, thanks for joining us on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Jason Chaffetz, thanks for letting me share a cup of morning coffee with you and Rachel this morning, who's sitting right beside me as we're talking to you. Thank you. Enjoy the 3 hours of radio.
Very good. Thanks again. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Look, I think the progressives in the party want to hold on to as much power as they possibly can. I think this election will really be decided by suburban swing voters. And the math of swing voters is that if the election's 5-5, one swing voter makes it 6-4. It takes two people staying home to overcome that swing vote. I think the left coming out against Biden is a gift because the left ultimately is going to vote for Biden. They're not going to vote for Trump. They're going to come out because they don't like Trump so much. And to the extent they throw an uncommitted, you know, softball at him, all they do is communicate. If the left is unhappy with him, maybe he's moving moderate. And that's what he needs to do to win this election.
That is Mark Penn. Who was, you know, he's a former senior advisor to the Clintons, but he was on Hannity, really insightful in terms of how elections work. It really is, I think, that's sort of the middle 5% of the electorate that will sway an election one direction or another. But it's really interesting now because, you know, all the talk about the cognitive capabilities of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and her inability to communicate herself and how dismal her numbers are. She really hasn't done anything. I don't think she can point to anything in her portfolio that she's actually done, even though she makes these pronouncements that, hey, I'm ready to do it. So the Democrats are really in a conundrum. And then you have people on the far left who are making a concerted effort not to vote for Joe Biden and in some cases saying, just stay home. Just if you do show up, vote uncommitted. Listen to Representative Rashid Tlaib in Michigan this past Saturday, Cut 17.
It is also important to create a voting block, something that is a bullhorn to say enough is enough. We don't want a country that supports wars and bombs and destruction. Right now, we feel completely neglected and just unseen by our government. If you want us to be louder, then come here and vote uncommitted.
Wow, vote uncommitted. I think Joe Biden is really in trouble in Michigan. If you look at all the swing states out there, the case I'd make is that there's real trouble is, and I think Donald Trump sees it too. Remember, Donald Trump was just there over the weekend is in Michigan as well. But you also have the union problems. You have the auto workers and whatnot. Well, they'll certainly go out, and they've endorsed and have endorsed and will endorse Joe Biden. The rank and file, I don't think they're with him. I think they understand that Joe Biden has actually taken the party. You know, remember, they wanted to get rid of all the combustion engines. They wanted to get rid of all of these automobiles that these people have been producing and do so with a green new deal and a push for electric vehicles, which cost them the very jobs. Now, you can talk about retraining all you want, but I don't think that's going to inure to your benefit in terms of, hey, how is it that we're going to, you know, grow the base? And I just think those auto workers think of all the subsidiary companies and all the suppliers and whatnot, they're looking at that as well, and they're saying, hey, we can't do this. And you combine that with the fact that Joe Biden just doesn't have much energy and enthusiasm. There's just not. Listen to Charlemagne the God. He was on ABC this week, and he's talking about Joe Biden. And this is one of the most influential people out there in radio, particularly with certain segments of our community. Go to Cut 22.
He has no main character energy at all. None.
And what is that? Is that age? Is it the way he is? I mean, what's the problem?
I don't think it has anything to do with age. You know, I think it has just everything to do with him.
I mean, it to say, look, it's not age. It just has to do with him. That was an interview with Jonathan Carl on ABC. And this is the core problem. You hear Democrats saying, hey, we need more Joe Biden, more cowbell, but, you know, the guy just doesn't have the energy. It's kind of slow Joe. That's the fundamental problem, and he doesn't have this reputation of working hard. I mean, he's headed to California today to do what? Go raise some money. But in terms of addressing the key issues that people are most concerned about, no, it's just not there for him. So I think Joe Biden's got a lot of problems, and I think one of the biggest problems in one of the biggest swing states is in the state of Michigan, where people are actively saying, if you show up, just vote present. Don't need to vote for Joe. That's going to really hurt him. I'm Jason Chaffetz. Stay with us. More to come on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Watch me.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, this is Jason Chaffetz. I'm filling in for Brian, and thrilled to do so. Always fun. There's so much happening in the world today, and I hope you had a good holiday weekend. I hope some of you took some days off. A lot of people were working, but thank you so much for joining us. I want to get into a different topic than we've been to so far, and that is talk about immigration and all the problems and challenges there and a couple other things. So we're thrilled to have a good friend, Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. Congressman West and I served together in the United States Congress. He's currently the executive director of the American Constitutional Rights Union. We served in Congress together. He's a good friend, Colonel Alan West.
Hey, Jason, how you doing?
Thank you so much for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Really do appreciate it.
My pleasure, and it's good to hear your voice, my friend.
Always good. So when you hear about the latest revelations about what's happening and not happening at the border, what's your top line take on what's going down?
Well, the bottom line, Jason, we should be very concerned because we are watching the undermining of our national sovereignty. We are watching the complete disregard of the constitutional duty and responsibility of the federal government to protect every state from invasion. And when you're looking at 8 to 9 to 10 million people that we know about, and then another 1.5 to 2 million that we don't know anything about entering into this country, this is aiding and abetting drug, human sex trafficking, and now we know terrorism trafficking, because there are cells that have come across that we're not able to track, and even the FBI director has alluded to that as well. So this is a very concerning time for the United States of America.
No, it is, and one of that was highlighted by Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri. He was on Hannity. Listen to his take on the threat of the Chinese nationals crossing the border. Cut eight.
Well, you know, it used to be 30 years ago, or really just for the last 30 years in total, that Wall Street and the liberals and the multinational corporations would send our jobs overseas to China. Now they're actually letting the Chinese nationals come here to the United States and take the jobs right out from under our noses. I mean, you talk about 20,000 Chinese nationals just since October coming into this country, taking jobs, driving down wages. Of course, China's already buying farmland, U.S. farmland, at a record pace, Kaylee. I mean, this is unbelievable. And clearly it shows that the border is completely open. Joe Biden wants it open. And for American workers, that is a disaster.
Yeah, it not only is it a national security threat, he's right about the working component here. And taking the jobs, but at bottom line, we flat out don't know who these people are.
No, we don't. And when you consider the fact that you also have a good amount of single military age males that are Chinese nationals coming to the United States of America. And I just got to tell you, I don't think Xi Jinping would be allowing tens of thousands of single military age males or Chinese nationals, period, to be able to depart from China. And we're not talking about something that's very cheap. I mean, they're not getting in a rowboat and rowing right across the Pacific Ocean. I mean, it takes you $30,000 to $40,000 to pay your way to the cartels to get you into the United States of America. So these are folks that are coming across multiple countries on aircraft. Then they're making the trek up from Panama through the Darien Gap. So this is not about people that are seeking asylum. This is about people that I believe have some nefarious reasons for them coming to the United States of America. And you also, we got to remember these Chinese police stations that we have here in the United States of America that are keeping an eye on, you know, Chinese expatriate dissidents that live here in the United States of America.
Yeah, no, that story, people aren't familiar with it. They really need to learn more about it. Laura Ingraham on the Ingraham angle, she did a really good job. She had these undecided South Carolina voters on her show, and they got a chance to weigh in on their concerns. Let's go to cut five. This is Matt Goines talking about, well, let's just listen.
The wall has not been completed. We've got to get that done. But I've also never met an American who would open the door and let someone in their house if you don't know who's coming in or who's on your front doorstep.
I mean, that is the basic principle, right? I mean, we legally and lawfully bring about a million people into our country every year. And on top of that, we have all these. But you know what, Colonel West, you know what just drives me nuts is that this is a choice. This is a choice by Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to open the door and let this stream of people every day come in. And I talked to Brandon Judd, who's the Border Patrol Council president, and he said, you know, we're just the welcome committee. We're not allowed to even do our jobs.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and that has to be frustrating. I've been down to the border about 15, 16 times here in Texas, and it is very frustrating for those Border Patrol agents, and it's even more so frustrating for some of these sheriff departments that are there in these counties along the border. They're not equipped to handle what is happening and going on. You talk to Brad Coe down in Kenny County. He's right there in between Eagle Pass and Del Rio. He's being overrun. But the thing that is, you know, so interesting, and like you said, this is willful, it is intentional, it is purposeful, and to what purpose? And I love how people try to change the language. I mean, this is illegal immigration, illegal aliens. And now everyone wants to say they're just migrants. No, that's not the case. They're trying to soften the language to make it more acceptable. And then you look at these policies and programs that they have in Massachusetts and now in Michigan saying, well, why don't you just take some of these illegal immigrants into your home and let them stay there? No. I mean, I have some relatives that I don't want to come stay in my house. I'm definitely not going to have people that I don't know who they are, and we don't know who they are. They don't have any identification, but yet we're allowing them to fly on our airplanes. We're allowing them to get on buses, and now we're saying that the American people need to have them in their homes. This is incredibly upside down.
All right, let me totally switch gears here with you. I want to talk about Israel and Iran and get your perspective. You have military experience and background. The bigger concern for me is I think one of the biggest threats in the world is Iran with a nuclear weapon. And the Biden administration and certainly the Obama administration has done everything they can to enrich and empower Iran. And I think that's one of the greatest threats to the world today.
No, you're absolutely right. And when you think about the Obama administration and the Biden administration, they upset the balance over there in the Middle East with Barack Obama welcoming Iran, welcoming the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, the Iranian nuclear agreement, which was unconstitutional. They tried to pass that through, not by way of treaty, but by executive action. And Joe Biden, who is basically Obama's third administration, tries to resurrect that. Never forget the pallets of cash that Barack Obama sent over to Iran, and of course the $6 billion that Joe Biden released to them. And we have eased up on the oil sanctions that we had against Iran. So we have now caused Iran to be flush with cash between the Obama administration and now the Biden administration. And therefore, what does that mean? That means your number one exporter of Islamic terrorism in the world is able to fund Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis. And that's why you see all of these attacks that are happening in the Middle East. So first and foremost, we've got to go back to diplomatic sanctions. We have to go back and strengthen and enforce those economic sanctions. We have to isolate Iran. And I think that will, once again, dry up the revenues that are flowing to people like Hamas and Hezbollah and to the Houthis as well. And we need to start doing what Donald Trump did. He took out Soleimani. The Iranians got the message. He took out ISIS. He took out al-Baghdadi, Islamic jihadists. They got the message.
Yeah, you got to speak their language, and their language is not a love language of, hey, let's coddle you and make sure that you're as comfortable as possible.
Yeah.
You know, it drives me nuts. We have the United States military, the biggest, baddest fighting force on the face of the planet, and you know what? Then we're over here dealing with the Houthis. Like there's some big, you know, group that can challenge the United States. I mean, if we wanted to wipe them off the planet, we could. But we choose to just, well, let's be nice and give them a little warning that, hey, here we come. And, you know, everybody hide under the desk. It's just unbelievable to me that we tolerate this and put our men and women in harm's way.
Well, the thing is that this administration is more so focused on proper pronouns to be used in the United States military and gender dysphoria and diversity, equity, and inclusion and all of these things. And they have made our military, which is a powerful military, a laughingstock. And that's why, again, you see Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, the Islamic terrorists, and also the narco-criminal terrorist organizations known as the cartels, they're making their advancements. And so it's important that we get a different commander-in-chief that is there that understands strength and might and Ronald Reagan's peace through strength ideology.
Ronald Reagan's peace through strength is just, in my lifetime, one of the most important things that happened to create peace around the world. All right, last question. The military has a major recruiting problem. I mean, the recruits are way down, and they seem to be lowering the standards rather than increasing the recruiting. What would you do if you were in that position to increase the recruiting?
Well, you go back to the policies that are effective for a military, the policies to train them, to equip them, to deploy them, give them clear goals and objectives, and allow them to do what they're supposed to do in dealing with our enemies. But that's not the case now. You get rid of all of these DEI programs, which are really talking more so about divisiveness in our military, this whole gender dysphoria push and all this LGBTQ stuff. That's not why people want to join the military. The people want to join the military to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America, and basically to kick the crap out of bad guys. And so we need to get back to that.
Yeah, well said. Colonel Alan West, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
My honor. You take care, Jason, and give the best to your wife and your family.
You as well. Thanks again. Again, Colonel Alan West, stay with us. We'll be right back on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, I'm Jason Chaffetz, filling in for Brian, and thrilled to do so. We were just on the line. We were talking to Colonel Alan West, and part of what we were talking about is Iran with a nuclear weapon and how Iran was funding, you know, all these rebel groups and these terrorist organizations, Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis. And literally in the commercial break, since we were talking about this with Colonel West, news came across, breaking news coming across, that the Houthis have successfully shot down a United States MQ-9 Reaper. This is primarily used for reconnaissance, but can be equipped with missiles. It's some $32 million asset of the United States of America, and the Houthis just shot it out of the air. Now, if the President of the United States ordered the United States military to take out the Houthi threat top to bottom, they could do so, I don't know, in a very short amount of time. They have continued to fire on the United States. They have continued to put our men and women in harm's way. They have continued to fight and push against shipping there in the area. If you look at it, it's just a, you know, you look at Yemen, it's directly below Saudi Arabia. You've got Oman and then Iran off to the east. And how we tolerate this as a nation, it's just infuriating. So the taxpayers putting up United States assets in international space, in international waters, in international airspace, and then to have the Houthis, how in the world can the United States of America be pushed around by the Houthis of all people? That's not the United States military that we pay some, what, $900 billion a year to have, to be pushed around by these folks. Take out the threat. Don't put our men and women in harm's way like that, Mr. President. How we continue to tolerate that and experience these types of attacks is just, I just don't understand why the Biden administration doesn't take more action on that. I really just don't understand it. All right, let's go to one other topic here before we get to the top of the hour and we need to go to a commercial. But, you know, it's an interesting time for the Oversight Committee. I used to chair the Oversight Committee. The entire time I was in Congress, I was on the Oversight Committee, and I was the chairman of the Oversight Committee. Now, James Comer is doing an investigation about potential for inappropriate behavior by the Biden family and their business efforts. So you have Jim Biden, who's the younger brother of Joe Biden, who will be testifying before closed doors in, I don't know if it's structured as a transcribed interview or as a deposition. There are two different ways to do it. Jim Biden is coming in tomorrow. He is supposed to go behind closed doors and answer questions. Then the following Wednesday, next Wednesday, you have Hunter Biden, who's supposed to come in and do his deposition or, again, transcribed interview. Both are transcribed, both are sworn, but the method is just slightly different depending, again, how they structure it. And That comes on the heels of Tony Bobulinski, who has also gone before the committee. Devin Archer has gone before the committee. And there's a host of others. And I think what you're going to see is the typical way you do this is you go and you do the transcribed interviews. You allow the staff. And again, it's bipartisan. What happens is they will sit there for an hour. The majority will go first. They will ask an hour straight worth of questions. They'll take a slight break. Take a glass of water, stand up, stretch, maybe go to the restroom. Then the Democrats get an hour. This goes back and forth as long as it takes. You could go on for days if you wanted to. There is no stopping. You may want to take a break and, hey, let's come back tomorrow and continue on. But we've had depositions in the past that go 8, 9, 10 hours. Sometimes they're much shorter than that, but you know, from what I hear in the committee, they literally have like more than 800 types of questions to ask because there's so much information on the Bidens. There's all kinds of information, banking information, emails, calendar items. You know, Democrats are out there saying, oh, well, there's no evidence of Joe Biden. Yeah, there's lots of evidence. Pictures, emails, voicemails, text messages, calendar items, testimony from other people. There's all kinds of evidence. And millions and millions of dollars that were flowing. Jim Biden has lots to answer. A part of it is about this AmeriCorps company. Now, the federal government is looking at AmeriCorps, and they're saying, wait a second, there is an investigation. I think it's $142 million in potential Medicare fraud, I believe, is the allegation that is being looked into, of which Jim Biden was involved and engaged in. But then the very day that there is a $200,000 payment from AmeriCorps to Jim Biden, guess what? Within 24 hours of that, Jim Biden is stroking a check to Joe Biden for $200,000. So he gets $200,000, he sends $200,000. Now they say it was a loan. You know, Joe Biden gave him a loan. Well, how is it that Joe Biden's got like hundreds of thousands of dollars? He's worked for the government at this point since 1972. I don't know how he has this much money to hand out. Now, in between his service as vice president running for president, yeah, he had book deal and he had some other things with some other income. But to hand out these loans, how come there's no documentation? Those are the types of questions that Jim Biden's going to get when he goes before the committee. And that happens tomorrow, about this time tomorrow. That's where Jim Biden's going to be before the Oversight Committee. The culmination, I think, will be some big public hearings that will come up in March or April. Stay with us.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Well, almost, Brian Kilmeade. Hi, I'm Jason Chaffetz. I'm filling in for Brian. Thrilled to do so. He's always so nice to let me every once in a while fill in for him. So I really do appreciate it. And there's a lot happening in the world. I mean, we can go all around. And it's unbelievable to me some of the things that are happening and that we tolerate as a nation. We should not be tolerating. But I'm thrilled to be joined. Who's joining us is Charlie Hurt. He's a Fox News contributor. He's columnist for the Washington Times, and he's like all everything at the Washington Times, but he's just an all-around good guy. Charlie Hurt, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no, I always enjoy the discussion with you. You know, we were talking about some breaking news about what was going on with the Houthis, how we tolerate as a nation these attacks by the Houthis. It's unbelievable. We had reported Fox is learning that an MQ-9 Reaper, this is a $32 million drone that we own, it has the ability to do reconnaissance as well as it can be equipped with missiles. It can be proactive. It was shot down, destroyed by the Houthis. Also getting word, just coming out of the Pentagon through our producers there, that a U.S.-owned Greek-flagged ship was targeted and hit. This evidently was carrying grain headed to Yemen. They're having a huge humanitarian crisis there. But this is being targeted and hit. Don't know whether this vessel sank or if anybody was killed. But the idea that the Houthis were able to take action and hit a U.S.-owned ship Charlie, I don't how the Biden-Harris administration tolerates this. I mean, we have the biggest, baddest fighting force on the face of the planet. Yeah. If we wanted to take out the Houthis, I got to believe we could.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's really amazing. And you know, it's a reminder of the old adage that, you know, you don't get to make peace. You don't get to you don't get to pick peace. Only your enemy can decide on peace. And when you have an administration like the Biden administration that completely lays down and offers no threat to anyone and is, you know, they move red lines, they make red lines, then they move them, and they present no front like they actually care about defending the country. And you know, of course, the open borders is a perfect example of that the whole world sees. And they just realize that these people are not serious. You know, it's funny. Enemies all around the world are going to take advantage of that. And I think that's exactly what's going on here. You know, the reason that this doesn't happen under other administrations is because our enemies are afraid that they're going to get absolutely annihilated. Because, like you just said, we have the most powerful fighting force on the globe. And you know, and it's funny, you know, you don't even have to always use the fighting force in order to keep the peace. If people just know or believe that you will use it, that's enough. And these people look at Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and they just sort of shrug their shoulders and say, they're not going to do anything. We can get away with murder. And so that's what they're doing.
Well, exactly. The most peaceful time in my lifetime was President Ronald Reagan and President Donald Trump. And the reason it was so peaceful is because we'd had an incredible military, and you had presidents that I think the other side thought, yeah, they might just come after us.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting because both of those men, they demonstrated restraint. They didn't go around wanting to get involved in things all over the place. You know, Reagan was loath to get involved in foreign disputes, but as you point out, when it came time to do that, he would. Same with Donald Trump. And the other thing about Donald Trump is that they also thought he was half crazy, and so they were terrified of him. And you know, if you can, Trump will say this openly that he, you know, he was glad to use that to his advantage, where he could say something, and maybe, you know, he could say, look, if you do this, I'm going to do this. And you know, he did this with North Korea. He did this with Russia. He did this with Xi Jinping. You know, even if they didn't really believe he would do what they said, what he said he would do, there was 10% of them that were like, he's just that crazy. And it goes a long way to keeping the peace.
Yeah, he also did, I think, Donald Trump. Look, Donald Trump knows how to negotiate.
Yes.
Right? If you had to find somebody to negotiate, would you pick Joe Biden or would you pick Donald Trump? To do this on your behalf, and clearly Donald Trump knows how to negotiate. Now, one of the interesting tactics that he uses, he's actually pretty praiseworthy of these international leaders.
Yeah.
Kim Jong Un, President Xi, Putin. I think he knows how to take the blood pressure down just a little bit. You don't have to prove your manhood with me. I will respect you. I will interact with you. But yeah, if you go and cross the line, I'm gonna kick your butt.
I'm gonna destroy you. Yeah, you don't. You don't pick unnecessary fights. You focus on the thing that you want, and everything. Let everything else just sort of be what it is. But the other thing is that, I think the point is negotiate, you know, the ability to negotiate. And the most important thing, I would say, like, the most important thing by far in negotiating is a very simple thing. It's what is your personal interest and how do you get it? And if you are focused on personal interest, what you want, and then, of course, you know, let other things slide, it doesn't matter. It's going to be very clear to everybody what it is you want. And then the other side realizes, okay, that's what that person wants. Well, this is what I want. And so then you can, You know the other word for that? America first.
Yeah.
And everybody freaks out in Washington when you say America first. But, of course, it's a simple declaration of what it is that you're interested in. And what else should you be? Mexico first? Right. Ukraine first? Russia first? It's insane. And these people in Washington are so they've been so watered down and so sort of mind warped into thinking that it's a bad thing to be self-interested. Our entire system of government, let alone our entire economy, but our entire system of government is built on self-interest. Like the whole reason we have separation of powers in Washington is that the judiciary is to jealously regard, to protect the powers of the judiciary, and the same with the legislative branch and the executive branch. Well, you know what happens? It doesn't make anything perfect, but you know what happens? Really good things come out of that, or not even necessarily really good things. The best possible things come out of that, because humans can screw everything up. But self-interest goes a long way. And I think that, to me, that with Reagan and Trump, that was the defining characteristic of both of them. They both were unashamed of embracing self-interest and saying, no, you know what? This is what America needs. America needs this. And therefore, we're going to fight for this. And we want to find a common ground to give you what you want so we get what we want. And then you get peace.
Yeah. Along with that, you know, I just don't believe that that the left and the Democrats, and certainly those on the, you know, on Capitol Hill, I don't think they truly understand Donald Trump. They never took time to understand him. They don't get him. They ignore him. They go after him. But they've never truly understood how this billionaire from New York is able to relate to blue-collar people and others. I want you to listen to this very quick exchange. This is Senator Elizabeth Warren on Pod Save America, flabbergasted, trying to explain why voters miss the Trump economy, because they think the Trump economy was just the worst thing ever. But people do remember where there was 4 years of Donald Trump and life was really good. Cut 20.
Why do you think that people... all these polls show, like, a lot of voters look back on the Trump years and they think they didn't like a lot about it, but they think the economy was good.
I don't know. I can't explain polling. No, I mean, I can't.
No, I don't.
I can't. And I can't explain how the narratives come to be. I also can't explain how sensitive are they.
They still don't get it. Maybe inflation has something to do with that. I don't know, Charlie.
Yeah, no, it's so funny. And I don't, I always struggle with this, because I tend to, and this is why I'm a dope who doesn't belong in Washington, I tend to try to ascribe best motives for people that I don't agree with, just because I'm generally interested in hearing what people I don't agree with have to say, because I figure, well, they must know something I don't know. And it's a very foolish way to go to approach Washington, because ascribing best motives to your opponent is a fool's errand in Washington. But that said, I've struggled with this. Trump can be a jerk. He says he's impolitic. He's vulgar. He says all this. And so, I do know people who don't like him for those reasons. And I get it and I understand it. But then there's this other part of me that I'm starting, or I'm certain that... And it's particularly politicians in Washington who despise him, not because of those things, or not even because they don't get him. It's because they are so terrified of him, because he is somebody who has broken down all the barriers, all sorts of barriers between Democrats and Republicans. And he has managed to steal so much of the Democrat base and bring it over to the Republican side. Obviously, he's alienated some portions of the Republican base, which is... you know, not optimal, but I get it. But his ability to, and like, you know, Democrats have run politics forever, our entire lifetimes, based on race and gender, and they try to, you know, divide everything into their identity politics, which is just all it is you know, political segregation, and they embrace it. And of course, you know, the Democrat Party has been the party of segregation forever. And so it shouldn't be surprising. But that's how they view the world. They view everybody by race. And then Donald Trump comes along and he breaks all that stuff down. and he wins over Hispanic voters talking about the wall and wins over black voters by talking about economic issues that Democrats have ignored, or crime or whatever it is that Democrats have ignored all this time. And it's just so interesting to me. I think that people like Liz Warren, what they hate about, and she knows she's not a stupid person. I think that what she recognizes about, she understands Trump better than she lets on. And she recognizes that he is there to destroy this system that Democrats and Republicans have put together in Washington. And it's a real threat to their existence because, yeah. You know, on the issues, oh, my gosh, if you could take Trump out of it and just had it on the issues, had like a blind taste, like a blind election where everybody just voted on like the issues and the success, the quality of success. Oh, my gosh. Trump would win with like 80% of the vote. It's so funny.
Yeah, and to say that people just don't how can they think that the economy was better under Trump? Because it was. Yeah. People understand their own pocketbooks. And I heard one set of people that were interviewed said, well, under Trump, I had money. Now I don't. Yeah. And when you go out to get a cheeseburger and fries and it's $18, that's a little pricey.
Is there anything more annoying than having somebody squall at you and tell you that you don't actually know that you're poor? You're fine. Oh, your head. You don't know what you're talking
about. Yeah, exactly. We're talking with Charlie Hurt, and he's going to continue to stay with us, I believe, for another block here. So stay with us. I want to talk about some immigration and things that are happening there. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Actually, today with Jason Chaffetz filling in for Brian, but I'm also joined by with Charlie Hurt of the Washington Times, also a Fox News contributor. Charlie, we are talking about a lot of things all over the globe, but I want to talk about the immigration crisis. It's not going away. It's not being solved. It could be solved, but it's not being solved. And what's your top line take on this? Because now we're hearing and seeing these video of this surge of migrants, particularly from China and Syria and other places all over the world, coming through Hakumba, California. The video is just stunning to see these people who we don't know are just coming through and walking right into the United States.
Well, I mean, I guess the top line would be, you know, think about the last 6 months or actually the last two, three years, how many times we've looked at each other and said, we've never seen anything like this.
Right.
And then 2 months later, it's like, we've never seen anything like this. This is nuts. This is crazy. And then 2 more months. And so we've had so many iterations of that. And so here we are now. How many more times between now and November are we going to look at each other and say, that whatever we're seeing today is nothing like what we are going to be seeing in 2 months? And whether that manifests itself in a terrorist attack, which, you know, security officials in Washington say they've never seen red flags like this since before 9/11. So is it going to manifest itself that way, or is it just going to be, some other crazy invasion we're now seeing? These images, hunters with their game cameras in along the northern border in Vermont.
Yeah.
Hunters are told to carry a pistol with them in Vermont because, you know, while most of the people coming across are just illegals trying to get in the United States, probably 10% of them are, bad actors who have something else in mind. 10%?
Well, listen to this.
10% of 10 million is a lot of people.
It certainly is, and it only takes a lot if you're
Yeah, exactly.
Laura Ingraham was interviewing a number of undecided South Carolina voters. Listen to this cut six. This is Eric Brown talking about his concern.
Human trafficking, for me, the part of that destroying our America as far as the thought of children being molested, it just sickens me.
I mean, I've got this whole list of cuts, if they call them, these interviews that she was doing, and they're talking about the fentanyl crisis, they're talking about human trafficking, they're talking about the sex trafficking, they're talking about how we neglect our own veterans and the homeless. To think this is just something that's on Fox News or you know, just the Republican right, I think the rest of the country is really starting to feel this and understand it. But Joe Biden's just indignant on this.
Yeah, and the only reason prior to this that, you know, more people didn't recognize it, I think, is because it really wasn't affecting them directly in their communities. And, you know, because but you know, places like Texas and Southern California and Arizona, you know, they've been aware of these problems forever. But suddenly once it gets in your face, you realize it really is. It's like an 80% issue, and Democrats are ignoring it.
Yeah, not only are they ignoring it, they're not getting rid of the sanctuary cities and sanctuary states. They keep inviting them in. Yeah. And then you read about more and more appropriations going to these people.
Yeah.
Charlie Hurt, Fox News contributor, Washington Times, all things at the Washington Times. Charlie Hurt, thanks for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Stay with us. We're going to be right back. Stay with us.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, this is Jason Chaffetz filling in for Brian, and thanks for joining us. Lots happening around the world. One thing I wanted to note, this is a particularly important anniversary. Back in 1962, John Glenn was the first American to orbit the Earth on this day in 1962. Amazing man, amazing life, amazing service to our country in so many ways. We miss John Glenn, but it's worth noting on this day that historic event happened, and look how far technology and the space race and everything has happened. It's just an important date that caught my eye today. We're thrilled to be joined now with somebody I've never spoken with, but Ambassador Adam Arely, I hope I pronounced that right, was the U.S. ambassador to the Kingdom of Bahrain. He was also the deputy State Department spokesperson for Secretary of State Colin Powell, as well as Condoleezza Rice. Ambassador, thanks for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Oh, wow. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I wanted to get your perspective, you know, your service overseas, your time and efforts and dedication there at the State Department. I want to get your take on what's going on with Israel, because it started out when Israel was attacked savagely, 1,300 I think plus people that were killed in this terrorist attack by Hamas. But you know, the president, I thought, actually did a good job of initially, President Biden, of initially saying, "Hey, we're all in, we're all supportive of Israel." But now, you get all these increasing number of reports saying, "Oh, well, we need to go a little softer. We can't be doing this." But what's your take on how President Biden has morphed over the course of time in his unequivocal supposed support of Israel?
Yeah, well, you know, I just think that Biden might start having buyer's remorse, right? I mean, he sort of like bought a car without bargaining, and now it's not everything he thought it was going to be. And by that, I mean, look, on the one hand, you know, the president had no choice but to say, "America stands by Israel. We'll do everything we can to help you." Because remember, Israel had just, you know, October 7th was Israel's 9/11.
Right.
And, you know, there was nothing an American president couldn't do but say that, right? And interestingly enough, I read an article today that says, you know, Biden is now more popular in Israel by a factor of like 10 or 20% than Prime Minister Netanyahu. So you know, that explains his statement, you know, right after the attack. But, you know, ever since then, Biden's been trying to kind of walk things back, right? Why? Because he's now holding a tiger by the tail, and that tiger is, you know, Israel and its attack on Hamas and its destruction of Gaza, which has killed almost 30,000 people and brought a huge out or created a huge outcry among people around the world, including the United States, including Democrats who would normally vote for Biden. So, you know, this is turning out to be a lot more complicated, I think, than anybody anticipated.
Well, let's get this is Michael Allen. He was on Fox and Friends First talking about the Biden administration. Of course, Michael Allen was the former special assistant for national security to President Bush. Cut 29.
Here we have Israel fighting terrorists in an existential threat, and I took it as the Biden administration shooting Israel in the back. Israel needs more time to deal with this terrorist force. I understand we have grave concerns about the humanitarian situation, so let's continue to press for assistance and aid to get through. But we wouldn't have been dictated to after 9/11 in Afghanistan if the world community was standing up and saying, hey, you know what, America, back down against al-Qaeda. By the same token, Israel ought to be given more time and space to finish the job in Gaza, and then we can help them pull back.
I mean, I think the goal here is to eradicate, dismantle, and destroy Hamas, is it not? The goal is clear. And when Hamas is the one that's using human shields, and when Hamas is putting assets and personnel in hospitals, guess what? There's a consequence to that.
Yeah, no doubt. I don't think the discussion or the debate isn't, you know, whether Hamas needs to be destroyed, right? Everybody agrees that's the goal, and it should be the goal. I think where there's some disagreement, including within Israel, I might add, is what's the best way to do that, right?
Right.
So for example, yeah, and oh, by the way, you know, I think that the fight against Hamas is very, very different than the fight against al-Qaeda. Because with al-Qaeda, we were going against some people in the mountains of Afghanistan, right? With Hamas, we're going after a resistance movement or a terrorist group that's embedded in the population of 2 million people in an area the size of Manhattan, or maybe smaller than Manhattan, and that have had years and years and years and years to disguise their operations in civilian areas. So it's an urban fight, not a fight in a faraway country that has no people. And that's a very different, you know, that's a very different problem set from a military standpoint than we faced in al-Qaeda. That's
yeah.
The question is about is means to means, not ends. How do you destroy them as opposed to whether you destroy them?
Yeah, there is a concerted effort by Israel to give advance notice. We are going to come here. We are going to bomb this. And let there be no doubt that they have. But when they give foreshadowing and they give warning, when they try to say, hey, we want you to exit to the south, and then they don't do it, or the Hamas doesn't allow them to escape, yeah, there's a consequence to that too. And
yeah.
I think Israel has done an incredible job of telling people, look out, here we come, get out of harm's way. But it's sadly, so many people have not. Ambassador, I got to switch gears with you in the short time that we have. We're getting news out of the Pentagon. Our producers there from Fox News are telling us that the Houthis have not only hit or targeted and hit a U.S.-owned Greek-flagged ship filled with grain headed to Yemen, but they have also destroyed, shot out of the sky, an MQ-9 Reaper, which is can be used for reconnaissance or can be equipped with missiles, a $32 million asset of our military. Houthis firing at the U.S. With impunity. They just do it, and there doesn't seem to be much of a consequence from the Biden-Harris administration.
Well, you're getting me on a sore subject.
Well, good. tell us what your raw thoughts are.
Well, the one thing you didn't mention is that I think CENTCOM, NASA, found or intercepted or otherwise seized an unmanned underwater vehicle, right, which is basically a drone that goes underwater, which is extremely dangerous, extremely lethal, and extremely sophisticated. And, oh, by the way, the Houthis don't have the capacity to build these things. Only one country does, and that's Iran. So, look, let's be clear. The Houthis are getting and oh, by the way, Deputy SecCom Commander Bradley Cooper said this on 60 Minutes over the weekend. He said, look, we have a lot of evidence that says, you know, the Houthis are getting the arms, they're getting the training, and they've got IRGC people in Yemen doing the targeting for them, right? Doing the targeting for them. So this isn't a fight with the Houthis. It's a fight with Iran. So if you're serious about defending commercial shipping and, oh, by the way, American seamen, then you go after Iran. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
How do you do that? How do you go after Iran without starting a world war? Do you physically, kinetically take out assets in Iran, or are there other ways to make the pain so great that Iran says, yeah, we really don't want to be doing this anymore?
Well, I don't think anybody wants a world war. Nobody wants a world war. I think there are steps short of that. One thing you could do is there are Iranian assets, naval assets in the region that are providing command and control for the IRGC who are operating in Yemen. Go after those naval assets, ships. They've got a cargo ship that they've converted into a command center sitting 10 or 20 miles off the coast of Yemen. Sink it. Sink it. What are you afraid of? That Iran's going to escalate? Well, you know, it's only a matter of time before they hit an American ship, American warship.
Yeah,
it just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense to me why we're holding our fire on this. Because sooner or later, you know, Iran is either going to make a mistake or a miscalculation, and we're going to have to do it anyway, like we saw when they killed our soldiers in Jordan. And we still didn't hit Iran. We went after their proxies in Iraq. You know, that's just beating around the bush without uprooting it root and branch, which is what we need to do.
Yeah, you have to cut off the funding so they don't have the money. That has to do. I don't think Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are serious about Russia, and I don't think they're serious about Iran. Because if they were, they would have energy production in the United States that would drive down the price and the cost of fuel. And if that happened on the world markets, guess what? Iran doesn't have the money that it needs to fight. Russia doesn't have the money that it needs to fight in Ukraine. That is the number one thing you can do to make sure that you starve the beast, so to speak. And the other thing is, there's no reason.
I disagree with you on that. I mean,
why?
Maybe it's true. You hurt Iran and Russia, but you also hurt our allies. You know,
why?
Hurt
why?
Our allies in the Middle East. But the other point
No, why? Wait, why would we hurt our allies if we are the ones producing and exporting?
Well, if Russia's not getting resources from its oil, because of the price, then same is true for Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Kuwait and all those other guys.
Oh, they can handle it, though. They can handle it. They are still going to be producing and making money.
If you want to squeeze Russia, the best way to do it is to give Ukraine every weapon it needs tomorrow. And that'll get rid of Putin much faster than slow strangulation on oil price.
Well, you got to be able to operate those weapons. And the other thing is we gave them tens and tens of billions of dollars. Now, where did that money go? Where did it get to? I just don't like the idea of giving them money. They should have been giving them actual weapons.
They're running out of ammunition. They're running out of ammunition because Congress hasn't passed an aid package yet that was put up there months ago.
Well, that's a whole other discussion about protecting our southern border before we actually start worrying about other people's borders. We'll hopefully have that further discussion. It's certainly one that's raging in Washington, D.C. Ambassador, we really, truly appreciate it. Adam Arely, did I pronounce it right?
Yes, that's right. Thank you, sir.
All right. Ambassador Arely, thank you so much for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Really do appreciate it. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
It's Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, it's actually Jason Chaffetz filling in for Brian. We've had some really good guests, really good discussion. We got a lot more to come, so stay with us. But a lot of calendar items out there happening. I just thought this would be worthwhile talking about what's happening because I like foreshadowing what's going to happen down the pike here. Tomorrow, Jim Biden. This is the younger brother of Joe Biden. He's been closely tied in with Hunter Biden and the Biden family business and the allegations of impropriety and using Joe Biden's name and inappropriately using that to drive millions of dollars into the Biden's bank accounts. And he's going to have to testify before the in a closed door. Deposition. Not sure if it's a deposition or a transcribed interview, but that's going to happen tomorrow before the Oversight Committee. Chairman Comer's been pretty good at releasing transcripts after the fact. They need to have those reviewed for accuracy and whatnot, and that's due to happen tomorrow. Now, he could come in and just plead the fifth. Might do that. Not only is he tied up in this federal investigation, Jim Biden, with AmeriCorps and the meltdown. I think they filed for bankruptcy, that organization. He was deeply involved in it. And there's some $142 million in Medicare fraud that I think is being investigated there. But also the $200,000 check, Jim Biden allegedly gets this $200,000 check from AmeriCorps. The very next day, he strokes a $200,000 check to Joe Biden. So some big questions about what was going on there. A lot of allegations. Politico did an in-depth report about Jim Biden and said that at one point some of the senior executives at AmeriCorps said, yeah, hey, I'm sitting right next to Jim Biden saying, hey, I'm sitting right here next to my brother. Talking about Joe Biden and also saying, hey, if what you're doing, AmeriCorps, with rural health care, this is going to be a really good thing. I think we can get a lot of exposure because Joe can talk about this on the campaign trail. He can talk about this in his campaign. And certainly the inference is that he could open up a lot of doors with his contacts overseas and in the administration. These are the allegations, the reporting that I've read. All going to be questioned tomorrow. And then a week from tomorrow, Hunter Biden comes in to do his. You know, all the bravado and everything he said about, oh, I want to testify. Okay, well, you're going to get your chance again, yet again. They're being very polite over there in allowing to come in for this transcribed interview. Again, I think the big question is, does he plead the fifth? Does he actually answer questions? Hunter Biden doesn't strike me as somebody who is very disciplined in staying on message and even keeping his mouth quiet if he has to. So will be interesting to see if he answers questions. Could be a fairly short event. Typically what you do is, having been the chairman of this committee, you pepper them with questions. If they continue to plead the fifth, at some point you kind of let that go, but you do probably throw 30 questions at them, and if at that point there's a pattern, and they will say, hey, he's just going to continue to do that, then, you know, you probably cut it off after a while, but you do go on for a little bit. And then I think the big one is August 19th, the Democratic convention starts. Will Joe Biden ultimately be the Democratic nominee? Personally, my guess, all just a guess, we're all guessing, right? I don't think he's going to be the nominee when they walk out of that convention on August 22nd. But we'll see. That's the political intrigue here. A lot of people, a lot of Democrats questioning whether Joe Biden has it in him. Will it be Kamala Harris? I don't know. That's kind of scary, too. So lots to talk about, lots to think about, but lots going to happen here in a fairly short amount of time. Thanks again for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Stay with us.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Well, not quite Brian Kilmeade today. This is Jason Chaffetz. Used to be in Congress once upon a time. Now I'm a Fox News contributor filling in for Brian. Always enjoy doing it. Thank you so much for joining us. We got a lot to pack in this hour, and I want to get right after it with one of my favorites. He is the chairman of the Competitiveness Coalition, Scott Brown, but you know him better as maybe the ambassador, former ambassador to New Zealand, and former United States Senator from the great state of Massachusetts. Please, I'm just thrilled to have Senator, Ambassador Scott Brown joining us.
Hey, it's great to be on. Good to hear your voice.
Yes, no, it's good to chat with you again. Competitiveness Coalition, what do you do there? Explain that to me.
Well, we try to take on Congress and the administration for basically taking away the innovation opportunities for our innovators. You have Lena Khan at the FTC. Excuse me. You know, most recently in my former home state of Massachusetts, iRobot and Elizabeth Warren joined forces with Lena Khan. Excuse me, and basically threw away 350 great-paying jobs working with Amazon. So we're fighting back with some of the stupid overregulation that really is not only affects our large employers, but our small innovators that are looking to get a leg up. And who's loving this but China? And they want to be number one, and we're number one. And if we keep it up, we're going to be number two.
Well, explain this. You had an op-ed in the Boston Herald. People can look it up. Scott Brown, Boston Herald. And about the FTC, you know, kind of shamelessly cheering on the collapse of the iRobot acquisition. What happened there? And you write about 350 jobs lost in the state of Massachusetts.
Well, when I was a U.S. Senator, I did a lot of work with them. I mean, this is a company that obviously does a lot with security, a lot with military, and just fantastic high-tech, fantastic innovators. And high-paying jobs. But listen, they were going to do something with Amazon to modernize their facilities and their opportunities. And as a result of that, you know, they didn't like it. Elizabeth Warren and Lena Khan didn't like it. So they did everything to squash that. And as a result, those jobs went away. And then they'll start outsourcing them to other parts of the world. And it's just typical of what this administration does. Anytime that we have something that's going well, and it's creating jobs, you know, for people who care about development and care about our opportunity to lead in this world, they squash it, and it's not right.
Now, the FTC also has a commissioners, you know, you've been pretty outspoken about trying to get these commissioners that were the Republican commissioners, because usually these things are structured such that they have to have a certain number of Democrats, certain number of Republicans, but they got to get those people confirmed.
Well, not only confirmed, one of the Republicans resigned because Lena's using this as the arm of the administration. Here's the problem, and what people need to understand. Yeah, Joe Biden's old, and is he competent? I don't think so. I don't think he's going to make it to the next election. But the way things look right now with the polling numbers and what's happening with every time they bring another lawsuit against Trump, he gets stronger and stronger and stronger, and it started with Alan Bragg's case. Don't forget. There are all these unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats, you know it, you were there,
yeah,
who are doing and imposing all these new regulations, and they see the writing on the wall, and they don't have a heck of a lot of time to screw this country up. You see it when it comes to immigration, you see it when it comes to innovation, you see it when it comes to energy and overregulation of every way, shape, and form. So these guys are very savvy, and they're very smart, and Joe Biden probably doesn't even know what they're doing, quite frankly. And so, you know, that's what we need to be worried about. And so you have those people stifling everything. I've never seen anything like it. When we have an opportunity to lower energy, no, well, let's screw that up. Well, we had an opportunity to create jobs, no, let's screw that up. And when does it stop? It's only going to stop if we take over, obviously, the presidency and shift the House and Senate and finally work together to figure this thing out.
Yeah, it is stunning to me how tone deaf they are, and it just makes you wonder, really, what are you doing that's in the best interest of the United States of America? You know, one of the more influential voices, particularly in the black community, is Charlemagne the God. He was on ABC this week a few days ago with Jonathan Karl. Listen to this exchange with Charlemagne and Jonathan Karl. Cut 21.
He's just an uninspiring candidate. Like, you know, there's nothing about, you know, Joe Biden that makes you want to listen to him. That's why he should be leaning on, you know, his vice president.
Has she met your expectations?
Yeah, no, she hasn't. Like, Donald Trump is, what, 4 years, 3 years younger than President Biden? But he just comes off a lot more youthful.
I mean, Slow Joe, it does not inspire a lot of people. It certainly his work ethic is, you know, it's like he's half retired at this point.
Well, listen, you know, I know a guy takes more vacations than anyone I've ever known. You have a situation where everyone in D.C. and everyone around the country knows that Joe is failing. It's sad. I know him. I worked with him. You worked with him. You know, I don't wish that on anybody. But this is the United States of America. We need someone who's there 24/7, 365, and it's certainly not Kamala. I mean, she's a joke. Hasn't even, you know, she's the border czar. And what's she done exactly for the border? It's nothing. Absolutely nothing. And, yeah, listen, he's old. But once again, as I said, everyone knows he's old, but that's not enough. The people behind the scenes are running the show, and they're screwing this country up badly. And we need to stop it. The illegal immigration issue is they're not migrants. They're illegal immigrants. They're here illegally. They should be processed, stopped at the border, like what happened with President Trump. And I've never, ever seen anything like it. And it's got to stop. I'm just so upset about it. And people need to get involved. They need to get involved in their local school committees and their, you know, to end the wokeness there. They need to get involved in their selectmen and state reps, state senator, U.S. senators, you know, and even higher. You got to get involved, folks, because, you know, as we're seeing our place around the world fail in our safety and security with the fentanyl and everything else that's going on, enough. Let's just stop. Enough.
Yeah, it's stunning to me that they just continue to let it go on. I mean, immigration's a really good example of they can take executive action. They can do something unilaterally, and they did make a fundamental change. And you're right, Kamala Harris, the borders are. I mean, and I look back above and beyond just being the so-called borders are. What has she done in the last 3.5 years? She's out there saying, oh, I'm ready. Ready for what? What have you been doing for the last 3.5 years? I yet to see something in her portfolio that she can point to and say, yeah, you know, I really took this on, and boy, we made life better for America. I don't see it.
Well, she's a great laugher. I mean, she knows how to laugh.
That is distinctive, yeah.
There must be like an open mic night she can go to and participate and laugh at herself. Listen, we need leadership right now. What's happening, obviously, in Ukraine, you know, Russia just took over a city. And listen, whether you like that or not, and what you want to support or not, we made a commitment. And if people are going to trust us around the world to honor our commitments, we need to follow through. And I'm sorry, whether you support Ukraine or Russia, bottom line is we're in it. We've made a commitment, and Biden screwed it up from day one. You know, we could rehash that, but now we're in it. So let's finish it properly. Give them the tools and resources they need to do their job. Otherwise, Putin's going to be emboldened. His economy's not hurting. He's doing all the oil on the black market, as you know. He's selling war machine materials all around the world. His economy's, you know, pretty good, considering everything that's happened to him. So we need to make sure that we finish the job and we get out of a lot of these situations that Biden has put us in. President Trump did.
Yeah, no, he did. And it was a lot more peaceful when you definitively laid out the goal, the line, and you have the wherewithal to back up what you're going to do. But, you know, it's just that's what you're wishy-washy. Well, one last thing, going back to the election, because – elections are so pivotal, but I still worry that the Democrats are far out ahead of the Republicans, not because of the issues, because probably, I don't know, I'm picking out a number, 80% of the issues Republicans can win on. There's some touchy subjects like abortion and democracy that Democrats will try to ride as their issues. But when you go down on safety, security, crime, the border, international, inflation, the economy. You know, you kind of look at the Republicans and say, okay, they're better off at that. But The world is controlled by those people who win. And I think Democrats are so much better at getting out the vote, leveraging unions, leveraging not-for-profits, and voting early, doing all those things that Republicans, they tend to complain about, but they don't really organize and get out the vote. How do you see it?
Well, listen, on the abortion issue, it's states' rights. It should go back to the states. Here they fought for 50 years to have it go back to the states, and now they want to bring it back and federalize it to pick a number. It makes no sense. And with regard to getting out the vote, well, why don't we stop complaining and start doing what they're doing until the rules change? Okay, yeah. Let's play by the rules. And they play by the rules, but they maximize every loophole. Well, damn it, let's do the same thing and stop whining. You know, just get out and do it. Let's play them, you know, toe-to-toe. It's just like a football game. You're not going to take your quarterback and put your fourth-string quarterback in or your punter in to play quarterback. That's what we're doing. You know, yeah, if you want to, if you don't like the ballot harvesting, you don't like all this stuff that they're getting away with, then damn it, let's do it ourselves. Let's
well,
go.
The chair of the RNC, the chair of the RNC, the quarterback, if you will, you know, or the coach, you're changing the coach right in the middle of the game in the fourth quarter with just a few minutes to go, in essence. But it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Ambassador Senator Scott Brown, the chairman of the Competitiveness Coalition, thank you so much for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Truly do appreciate it.
Hey, God bless you and God bless America. Go get them, everybody.
Thank you. Scott Brown again. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Remember to check out Brian's show, One Nation, Saturdays at 9 p.m. Eastern on Fox News Channel. If you already have plans, set up that DVR and watch when you get home. That's One Nation, Saturdays at 9 p.m. Eastern on Fox News Channel. Be there.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, this is Jason Chaffetz filling in for Brian. I want to give a quick shout out to my book, The Puppeteers, The People Who Control the People Who Control America. You want to understand what's really going on in the White House? Who's really control? Check out my book. It was 4 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, The Puppeteers. There's an audio version of it. You can get the ebook. You can get the hard copy, but The Puppeteers. Also want to play this little clip from Newt Gingrich, who was on primetime with Jesse Waters about what we were just talking about with Senator Scott Brown. Cut 14.
And I think we have to start with two different sides. One is Republicans have to get into the game of getting people to vote very early, getting them to go to the polls, but vote by mail, do whatever. But I was very disappointed in the New York special election, where clearly the Republican National Committee's bank the vote effort had failed totally. So if you're not in the game, if you're not even trying, you shouldn't expect to win.
Republicans tend to complain about things. Voting is administered at the state level and by the counties, and many of the ways we vote have changed. Now, if it was up to me, everybody would vote same day, same time. You'd have an identification. I wouldn't even have vote by mail. I wouldn't have that. There's certain people, like our military, maybe people who come in and say, hey, look, I'm going to be out of town. I want to do a vote like that. But to just go out in mass and do this, I think is fundamentally wrong. I think chain of custody is a very, very important thing. But the rules changed, and Republicans, you haven't changed, helped to change the rules. So you got to play by these rules. Ballot harvesting, vote by mail, all this. These are things that the Democrats have mastered, and Republicans are just trying to figure out. You better get your act in line if you're going to actually make a difference. That's my preaching for the moment. I want to shift here because at the top of the hour, noon Eastern, and I know this show doesn't always play at the exact time, but at noon Eastern, Nikki Haley has a press conference. Now, there's some speculation online. She's calling this state of the race. Is this Nikki Haley dropping out of the race? Now, she's vowed that she's in it. She's in it to win it. She's going to keep playing forever. How many times have we heard that from candidates just before they drop out? I think it's interesting. State of the race, maybe she's just kind of laying the groundwork. But when you're polling 25-30% below the front runner in your home state where you were governor, maybe, just maybe, this is the time where she says, you know what, I'm actually out. I'm no longer a candidate for the presidency of the United States. I don't know. Pure speculation. I don't see anything official. I don't see anything from Fox News that's saying this is what's happening. I just see on the bottom of the right screen of the Fox News television that's coming across that looks like, you know, they're going to cover it. Nikki Haley addresses the state of the race. But there's also other speculation online. Is this, should this be the time for her to drop out? Perhaps. Let's listen to Ben Domenech. He was on the Ingram angle with Laura Ingram. Let's go to Cut 13, get his take on what Nikki Haley should do.
I don't think she has any shot in 2028, so I don't think that it's actually going to hurt her chances to stick around because they were so low anyway. Look, Nikki Haley represents the past. She's a callback to, you know, the before time, the long ago. You know, really, in a way, I think that, you know, what she represents is, you know, sort of the last-ditch act of a Republican Party that wants to be more corporatist, less populist, and less in touch with its own voters. And I think that that's, unfortunately, the person that you ended up with as the last fallback in case of Donald Trump having the kind of legal problems that you referenced. It's something, though, that I think is increasingly unlikely.
Yeah, it's just, it's really amazing to me that there's a lot of people who are saying, look, Nikki Haley has no shot in 28, but I don't think she has any shot in 24. If you can't win your home state, where else are you going to win? I think the writing was on the wall in Iowa when when Donald Trump won 98 out of the 99 counties and only lost one by one vote to Nikki Haley. I think the writing was on the wall. Nikki Haley came in third in Iowa. She worked hard. She spent tons of money to try to do it, but no, Ron DeSantis, I think, actually did it right. You know, he fought hard. He made the case, hey, policy-wise, I'm very similar to Trump, but I don't come with the drama and the legal problems. I've got a case to be made that the way we run Florida is the way the country should go. I thought Ron DeSantis did actually run a campaign because his voters were actually Trump voters. It's just the Trump voters said, no, we're going one more time with Trump. But I think the way that Governor Ron DeSantis exited the stage, yeah, he fought against Donald Trump. Yeah, he said something. But, of course, it's a competitive race. Of course he's going to do that. But he didn't make it overtly personal. And I think Ron DeSantis, in retrospect, will be viewed as, you know what, a solid candidate, made a good case. Young, he's the future of the Republican Party in many, many ways, and will be the most viable candidate, I think, going into the 2028 presidential campaign because of how he exited the stage and what he did. Nikki Haley, coming up at noon Eastern time. Does she drop out of the race? Does she try to make the case? Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. Stay with us on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Always love coming in with a little Fatboy Slim music to kick things off. And I'm Jason Chaffetz. I'm filling in for Brian Kilmeade. Just also want to mention, I got a podcast. It's called Jason in the House. Jason in the House podcast. Just anywhere you watch podcasts or listen to podcasts, I should say, type in Jason in the House and you'll find it. Actually, the podcast that I have up right now is a more in-depth conversation with Congressman Rob Bishop. Now, some of you may know Rob Bishop. Some of you may not know Rob Bishop. But Rob Bishop retired from Congress recently, a few years ago. After serving 18 years, he was a congressman from Utah. That's how I know him so well. I was a congressman from Utah. He was a congressman from Utah. He was an educator for years and years before that. He served in the state legislature in Utah. He was actually the Speaker of the House in the state of Utah. And he's an all-around good guy. Once you get past the initial gruffness of Rob Bishop, then you're going to love the guy. But if you don't get past that threshold, look out. He is a fun, fun man, very insightful, and thrilled to have Congressman Rob Bishop joining us on the line.
Thank you. Gruff, huh?
Yeah, gruff is a really good way to describe the initial meeting I had with you. Yes. Yeah, it was gruff. Gruff is a really good word.
Well, I'm sorry for that.
No, you're not. You're not. You're just playing nice out here on radio. But listen, and I say that with a big smile on my face because Rob is one of my favorite people. And Rob Bishop has written a new book. And I want you to, if you are really fascinated about Congress and how it actually really works, you know, not the way those political scientists tell you that it works, the way somebody who is actually in Congress about how it actually works and how it should work, what the history of it is. He's written this great book. It's called The Things I Learned in Congress They Never Taught in School. The Things I Learned in Congress They Never Taught in School by Representative Rob Bishop. Fascinating book. Mike Lee, Senator Mike Lee, and I helped write a little bit of a blurb there at the beginning of it. But why did you take the time? Because this is a major effort that you put out to come up with this book. Why did you do it?
That's a really good question that I don't have an actual answer to. I realized when I got to Congress that the stuff I had been teaching in my legislative units, back even in AP government classes in high school, they didn't hit the mark. They were just not right. So I wrote down the things that I had experienced in Congress that I wish I had had while I was still teaching school to the reality of what was going on. And I just felt compelled to do it. And so when I would be flying back from Washington to Utah or from Utah to Washington, and you know that can be a very lonely four-hour flight, I always had the laptop there and I kept writing stuff down. I just felt compelled to do it so that I had those experiences. And now my goal is to share them with other people, especially those who are teaching history or teaching government classes, stuff that actually I think puts in perspective how Congress actually does operate.
Yeah, one of the chapters that I saw in here, you know, that you have in here is chapter 10. It can't hurt to talk unless you're in Congress, which tell us about that.
It is one of the oddities that people think you go to Congress to pontificate. A lot of members of Congress think they go there to pontificate about the major issues of the day. But if you attend as a visitor, you'll find there's no one actually sitting there watching or listening. There may be two people doing, and they're good debates, but there's only two people doing that, which simply means that the way we roll votes, which means you all come together at a certain time period to make a whole bunch of votes, which is supposed to be an efficient way, means that there is no one to listen to what the arguments are being made before they vote, which means most people vote in a lack of ignorance. The idea that I think everyone has is that you listen to the debate and then you vote. We do it the exact opposite in Congress. You go vote and then you ask somebody, does anyone know what this does? Or you go to your staff and say, listen to the debate. It's a procedure that we instituted supposedly for efficiency, but what it does is mean we don't really know what we are doing, and therefore you have to rely either on staff or specifically on leadership to help you do what you need to do. And that is not the best way of Congress. That's not the way it was originally established. That's not the way it originally happened. There are histories of those first years of Congress where congressmen would go there just to be entertained, and congressmen would specifically go into the chamber to listen to the debate so they would know what the issue was, and often the debate changed their opinions. Doesn't happen today.
So there's so much criticism about the lack of, you know, that Congress just isn't working. It doesn't happen. Now, the majorities are slim. People have gone further to the right, further to the left. But as you look back on your time in Congress and you look at it now, and somebody says to you, what's wrong with Congress? What would you say?
There are a lot of structural things that are a problem with Congress. But I think the biggest issue right now is how closely divided Congress is numerically, which illustrates how closely divided the people are as well. In Congress, especially the House, more than the Senate, but especially the House, it is a team sport, and yet there are times when an individual member of the House has to be an individual to stand up for his or her district. But the key element is how you balance those two things out. I know there are some people who are talking a great deal about how the party needs to come together and we need to be unified and everything. But when I was back there as chairman of the committee, those same voices on my committee were the ones that gave me the biggest problems in trying to get a cohesive package done and out of the committee. It's a balancing act. And members of Congress need to know how to balance working for the better good of the country versus working for the better of your district. And if you're not being an individual for your district, you're only doing it for yourself because you think politically or philosophically you have all the answers, you're basically a narcissist and shouldn't be there in the first place.
Yeah, you're just trying to grow your social media profile or something. We're talking with Congressman Rob Bishop. The things I learned in Congress, they never taught in school. You know, one of the things that was always just fascinating to me, and you were really a leader. When I was there, you really helped lead this effort. Congress has its tentacles in everything. I mean, try to think of an issue where the federal government isn't involved. It's really hard to do that. And yet, I think our budget would get in line. Our product that came out of Congress would be better. Not only if the process was better on how we actually do appropriations, but if we just simply, as a people and as a Congress, said, no, that's not what the federal government's supposed to be doing. You got a lot of examples of that, but share some of your thoughts on that with the audience here.
It is essential for people to understand when the founders wrote the Constitution, I think the greatest patriot was Sir Isaac Newton, even though he never lived over here and he died a half century before the revolution started. But he was the one, as a physicist, that came up for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. The founders believed that. Founders believed that you couldn't write a law to make everyone be good, but you could structure government so that there would be one group would offset another group, so no one group or one person or cabal would have too much power. That's the important area. We in Congress have to realize that one of the reasons that you did that was so there could be a vertical separation of power between the states and the national government. They would balance each other off, not dominate, but balance each other. And that meant that everyone should have a sphere of action. I think it was James Wilson who said the Congress, the system of government where you have two masters, a state and a nation, can work if we function like the solar system where everyone has our plane, our source, our area of expertise, our area of work, and we don't interfere with the others. But if we function like a bunch of comets that fly through the planetary system, we will leave chaos in the wake. That's what Congress has done. The more it tries to do what could better be done by local government and better be done by states, Congress needs to realize there are things we can do well, and if we stick to that, we will do well. We will also spend less if we stick to that. And people will have the ability of choosing what kind of I'm sorry, I'm rambling here. Just stop, cut me off when you want to. There are some people that do want a big and fulsome government to do lots of things for them, and if they're willing to pay for that, fine, let them do that. There are others that want individual freedom and liberty and personal choices. Let them do that. If you trust in federalism, if a state wants to tax its people to do everything and people are happy with that, give them that choice and opportunity. But another people that don't want that approach, give them that opportunity. That only happens in the concept of federalism where you allow states to make real choices. Sometimes those choices would be bad, but that's okay. That is the important part. People need to have choices.
Yeah, that's why we have California. They can make really bad decisions, and they have a really bad, really bad state that's poorly performing, and people are moving out in droves. That's called California. So, so last question. If you could wave your magic wand and make one change, is that the change you would make, or what would be the one change you'd make in Congress?
There are so many. I think Congress needs to, first of all, force people by the way they structure their arms. And if you remember Eric Cantor, when he was majority leader, he tried to make all sorts of reforms to the way we do things so it would be a more family-friendly Congress. Structure it so people would actually be forced to be there and listen and talk to one another, that we would have deadlines of when we actually had to get things done. And when it comes especially to the budgeting, we don't have a process. We what do we have, 12 separate budgets people vote on?
Yeah.
there is no way to prioritize between those budgets. You can do it within a budget. But if you think we're spending too much money on, like, defense and need to spend more on parks, there's no way of moving that money from one silo to the other because of the way we structure things. That is not an efficient way of prioritizing what is really important in government.
Therefore, well, one of the things I would do, I would get rid of, I would abolish the appropriations committee. I'd just get rid of them. Make the appropriators the authorizing committee. So when you were the chairman of natural resources, you should also hold the purse strings. And that would get people's attention. That would get the administration moving in the right direction. There's nothing more infuriating than funding programs that weren't authorized by Congress. And it happens in mass. It happens in mass.
And it does. And that's the way originally it was at one time. Up until about the 1920s, the appropriations process was done by the individual committees. If you passed the law, you also had to pass the appropriations that went along with it.
Amen,
and there was
brother.
Some kind of control. And the other thing we need to get rid of is waiving all points of orders against appropriations bills, which means if a program has not been reauthorized by Congress and it's supposed to, appropriations can just fund it, whether it's been reviewed by Congress or not. We need to start reviewing more of these programs and reauthorizing them, not just letting them go on eternally because they were always there.
Well, we've got a few more hours of discussion on how to fix Congress. But what I can tell people right now is go on Amazon, go wherever you buy books. Representative Rob Bishop, easy to spell and remember. The Things I Learned in Congress They Never Taught in School. It's a great book. Thank you so much for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Good luck with the book. And see, you're not so gruff. I just said at the beginning, you're actually a nice guy. One of the good guys to serve in Congress. An honor to serve with you. And thanks again for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Thank you for having me. It's good to talk to you again.
All right. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Educating, entertaining, enlightening. You're with Brian Kilmeade. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, this is Jason Chaffetz. Many thanks to Brian Kilmeade, one of the hardest working guys in all of, I mean, he's just a hardest working guy, period. He's amazing what he does. And every once in a while, there's an opportunity to fill in for him. And the fact that he'd tap me on the shoulder to do it, I'm really honored that I would do that. He got a great staff behind him and supporting him. It makes this somewhat easy. But I really thank them for being able to host these few hours. As we kind of wrap up the show here, I want to draw a note to what's going on. Here at noon Eastern time, it's Fox News is reporting, you know, Haley to make a campaign announcement. Is she dropping out? Is she dropping out? That's the question. She's also scheduled to be later on at Fox News at 3 o'clock with Martha McCallum on The Story, 3 p.m. Eastern. But let's listen to Cut 9. This is Haley, Nikki Haley, last night.
But I'll promise you this. I am in this fight. I will take the bruises. I will take the cuts. This is going to be messy. And I'll take the hurt. Because I believe nothing in good comes easy. Sometimes we have to feel the pain to appreciate the blessing.
So you say that yesterday, and today you're having a campaign announcement at noon. I don't know what that campaign announcement is. Maybe she's got an endorsement somewhere. I don't know. But maybe she's dropping out. We'll find out really soon. I think the other question is, what's Joe Biden going to do? Joe Biden going to drop out? He's got a lot of people there on the left side of the aisle, including Ezra Klein, the New York Times columnist, saying, what should Biden do? Cut 19.
To say this is a media invention, that people are worried about Biden's age because the media keeps telling them to be worried about Biden's age, if you've really convinced yourself of that in your heart of hearts, I almost don't know what to tell you. In poll after poll, 70 to 80% of voters are worried about his age. This is not a thing people need the media to see. I think Biden, as painful as this is, should find his way to stepping down as a hero. And then I think Democrats should meet in August at the convention to do what political parties have done at conventions so many times before. Organize victory.
Yeah, I think it's increasingly difficult for Joe Biden to make the case that he has got the vibrant skill set to drive America forward for four more years. Now, I don't agree necessarily that he would step down as a hero, but I think a lot of people on the left would do that, would try to put him up as a hero. That would be a stretch, to say the least. I mean, what he's done to America, how he's done it, the selection of Kamala Harris. Oh, my goodness, if she's up next. I mean, it begs the question, who would fill in that spot? And it's just so untenable. But, you know, Joe Biden keeps making the case that he's going to do it. He's running around the country. Today he's on his way to California to raise more money. But certainly his ability to take the fight to Donald Trump, it's got to be more for the Democrats than to just go scorched earth and say, oh, Donald Trump is a threat to democracy. At the same time, your party and your efforts are to take Donald Trump off the ballot. That doesn't seem like a very Democratic thing to do. You know, they keep talking about, oh, the threat to democracy, and he's going to create all these wars. Well, you know what? Wars have happened under Joe Biden. They didn't happen under Donald Trump. Oh, Donald Trump will destroy the economy. The economy was better under Donald Trump than Joe Biden. So every time you kind of hear these arguments from the left, you just kind of smile and laugh and say, hey, we had 4 years of experience with Donald Trump, and it was really good. So all eyes, I think, coming up here in the next few minutes, Nikki Haley, does she drop out of the race? I think she should have dropped out a while ago. That's my own personal take, but we'll see what happens in a few minutes. I'm Jason Chaffetz, filling in for Brian Kilmeade. Been an honor to do so. Thanks for joining us on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Hope you have a wonderful, wonderful, safe, and prosperous day.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.